Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1012, Food for Thought, part 2. This is being recorded on June 26th of the year 2018. This program is a follow-up to both For the Record 912, done 100 programs ago, and also AFA 39. It overlaps those programs, and in turn, it draws on material, draws on and or references, is predicated upon material presented in other programs about what I believe is a very convincing pattern of evidence suggesting that AIDS was deliberately created. I think in all probability it was created under a clandestine biological warfare research program in this country, in turn building on research that had been done by the Third Reich and involving elements brought into this country under the auspices of Project Paperclip or Operation Paperclip. That is the by now relatively well-known program through which top Nazi scientists in a number of fields were brought into the U.S. In this program, we will not have time to detail or set forth much of the information that was presented, again, in For the Record 912, but in particular in AFA program number 39, a massive anti-fascist archives program, bringing together things from the history of biological warfare research, from the history of Operation Paperclip, and from things that impinge on the so-called New Age, in particular, quote, the Nine, unquote. An awful lot of New Age, and I hesitate to call it philosophy because it really is not philosophy. It is a form of quasi-religious propaganda, involves, quote, the Nine, unquote. This is alleged to be a group of super space aliens, nine in number, from which the gods of Egypt and just about everything else on Earth and elsewhere evolved from. The nine are alleged to be space aliens. They are tall. They are alleged to be tall, with fair skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. And it is alleged by the dupes, frankly, who adhere to the so-called New Age, that all human beings on Earth are descended from the nine, except for the African race, thereby clearly implying that they are inferior. In AFA program number 39, we discussed the Institute for Noetic Sciences, that's N-O-E-T-I-C, sciences. That is the epicenter of much of the gobbledygook subsumed under the so-called New Age. Its co-founder was none other than Werner von Braun, the SS officer who was the top researcher at the Third Reich's rocket facilities that built the V-1 and V-2. He later, of course, became arguably the most famous or best known of the paperclip scientists to come to the U.S. I remember as a kid watching Wernher von Braun on the Walt Disney Weekly program. And so he was relatively well known, and along with other Third Reich alumni, exerted a profound influence on the development of the U.S. space program. It is not as well known that former SS officer von Braun, who actually selected the unfortunate souls who were targeted for ultimately lethal slave labor in the Nazi rocket assembly facilities at the Dora concentration camp, or actually which were fed from the Dora, that's D-O-R-A concentration camp. Von Braun's apologists have maintained that he really didn't know anything about this, or that he was very shocked, shop to learn that, in fact, slaves were being used to build the rockets and that he was terribly upset. There is nothing of the kind on the historical record. In fact, again, von Braun was an officer in the SS, and he personally selected the slaves to be sent to Dora, most of whom were ultimately worked to death. And again, that enlightened soul, former SS officer Werner von Braun, is the co-founder of the Institute for Noetic Sciences, arguably the most important epicenter for the so-called New Age. And one of the foundations of the so-called New Age is the Nine, the tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned space aliens from which we all evolved. Except, of course, for black people. And again, in AFA 39, I propose that at some point in the future, after global warming and the unintentional spreading of disease via genetic engineering and GMOs, the deliberate spreading of disease involving genetic engineering of pathogens, and general social chaos had basically brought the human race to its knees. At some point, UFOs, and UFOs are quite real and do not come from outer space. The available evidence suggests very strongly that UFOs were developed by the Third Reich as late model anti-aircraft vehicles or machines. I've gone into that in other programs. Suffice it to say, you've seen a frisbee thrown. A frisbee is a disc-shaped airfoil. It flies just fine when the motive force of one's hand is applied to it. And the notion that human beings, with all of their remarkable aeronautical engineering skills, could not build something that involves some of the same features as a frisbee is simply not credible. I think at some point in the future, when, again, humanity is brought to its knees, the economy has collapsed, the environment is unlivable, diseases, intentional and unintentional, are ravaging the human race, wars have broken out, and a suffering, uneducated, and a thoroughly hysterical human race will, at one point, rather like the old Superman TV series, say, look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's space aliens from Uranus. It will be our brothers from space, the Nine, the tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned, quote, space aliens. And when they come back, of course, they will reveal that, well, all people descended from them except for those nasty black people who are, of course, inferior. This is somewhat off in the future. I want to enter some information from AFA 39 into the record on this program to supplement what we talked about in For the Record 912. And we are also going to be talking about a company called JAB Holdings. That's J as in John, A as in Apple, B as in Boy Holdings. That is the property of the very wealthy, very powerful, and very secretive Reimann family, R-E-I-M-A-N-N. The Reimann family, like 3G Capital, owned by Brazilian national and Swiss resident Jorge Paulo Lehmann, according, in addition to some other Brazilians with Germanic names. 3G Capital, I believe, is in all probability a Bormann company. They have been buying up food products and beers. Its InBev subsidiary has made major investments in beers and other liquors. JAB Holdings also is involved with many big-name brands, including food companies. In the last several years, JAB Holdings has been moving forward in a very big way into the field of coffee and coffee-related products like donuts and things like that. We're going to talk about that. The Reimann family is very secretive, I suspect, and again, it is no more than conjecture, but I strongly suspect that the Reimann family is part of the Borman Capital Network. In For the Record 912 and in AFA 39, we spoke about how the Bayer Company had purchased the Monsanto company, arguably the leading producer of GMOs. Other companies, including Bayer Crop Science, have been heavily involved in producing GMOs. But with Monsanto, which is the best known of the firms producing GMOs, having been purchased by Bayer, and with a genetically engineered pathogen, i.e. AIDS, to which only purebred Northern Europeans have a hereditary immunity, I think we are poised to perhaps witness at some point in the future the use of pharmaceutical products and food products to disseminate genetically engineered binary pathogens to which only purebred Northern Europeans, such as, for example, the tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned space aliens evolved from and including the Nine, have a hereditary immunity, and against which nobody else will have a hereditary immunity, which will place them basically S-O-L. Again, I've spoken about AIDS as a biological warfare weapon in many programs. AFA program number 16 is the longest. I've also spoken about it in 682. A very important show is 686, number 606, and again in For the Record 912 and AFA 39. We're going to highlight some aspects of that in this program as well. In a book called A Higher Form of Killing by Robert Harris and Jeremy Paxman, the 1982 paperback edition, there is a quote from a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for the defense budget for fiscal year 1969. It talks about the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare and directly foreshadows the development of AIDS. From A Higher Form of Killing, in turn, from the Congressional Record, the House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for the defense budget for fiscal year 1969. Quoting now from Harris and Paxman, as long ago as 1962, 40 scientists were employed at the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratories on full-time genetics research. Many others, it was said, appreciate the implications of genetics for their own work. The implications were made more specific that genetic engineering could solve one of the major disadvantages of biological warfare, that it is limited to diseases which occur naturally somewhere in the world. Quote, and this from directly from Dr. MacArthur's testimony before the House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing, within the next 5 to 10 years, and this is 1969, within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. The possibility that such a super germ, unquote, may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside. Again, this quote, because this is something, this is again 1969, and this is practically the clinical definition of AIDS, and yet this is in a defense House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for the defense budget, and it talks about the application or the possible application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory, meaning it would be resistant to and or breaking down the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. The possibility that such a supergerm, unquote, may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside. In For the Record Program 606 and in 686 and again in 912, we've noted a number of important things to be evaluated in conjunction with the passage from A Higher Form of Killing. By the way, in 2002, that book was reissued after it had come under the purview of the Bertelsmann Company, which acquired Random House and other imprints. And the passage I just read you is not included at all in the 2002 version. Bertelsmann was the publishing house for the SS, and Heinrich Mohn, the patriarch of that firm, was actually a member of the SS. Dirk Bodenbaum, the house historian for Bertelsmann, for those who might say, well, that was a long time ago, Dave. Dirk Bodenbaum, as late as 1998, again, the house historian for Bertelsmann, the official publishing house for the SS in World War II. He published a book as late as 1998 called Roosevelt's Way to War, in which he blamed World War II on Franklin Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control of the U.S. news media. An interesting take on World War II. Bear in mind that Bertelsmann, along with the Random House and their other imprints, now controls more English-language publishing than any other individual firm. I believe their overall market share is greater than 50% of the English book publishing market. It's certainly huge. We have also noted again in For the Record 606, again in 682, 912, and AFA 39, that there is in fact a hereditary gene, the CCR5 Delta 32 gene, that confers a genetic immunity, a hereditary immunity to HIV infection. It is only present in purebred Northern Europeans, quote, Aryans, unquote. Only the white race has it, no other race has it, and it is only purebred Northern Europeans. One of the things we've looked at in For the Record 606 and also again in 912 and AFA 39 is the fact that that gene also afforded immunity to the Black Death. The Black Death was for many years and still very widely believed to have been bubonic plague. In fact, the available evidence now suggests that the Black Death was not caused by bubonic plague, which is a bacteriological disease, but rather by a viral hemorrhagic fever. And that there is evidence of that particular fever may also very well have been researched for biological warfare purposes, in particular by the Japanese at the Unit 731 facility in Manchuria. The files for that were incorporated into the U.S. Biological Warfare Program at the end of World War II, and they are basically classified. Another thing that we looked at in AFA 16 and that we came back to in For the Record 912, AFA 39, and in particular in For the Record 686 is the fact that when Fort Detrick, the military's top chemical and biological warfare research center, was ostensibly turned over to the National Cancer Institute to become a civilian cancer research facility. In fact, it was maintained for the NCI by Litton Bionetics, formerly Bionetics Research Systems Incorporated, a wholly owned biotechnology subsidiary of Litton Industries, a major defense contractor. and they basically ran Fort Detrick. One of the things that we looked at in For the Record 686 is that the key people involved with Litton Bionetics and that program were all veterans of the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program, and that the cell cultures for the National Cancer Institute's Special Viral Cancer Research Program were developed by those very same high-ranking members of the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Team. Again, bear in mind that only purebred Northern Europeans have the hereditary immunity to infection by HIV. It also conferred immunity to the Black Death, whether or not that was bubonic plague or whether the viral hemorrhagic fever it is now believed to have the Black Death stemmed from. Again, a disease which also appears to have been researched for biological warfare purposes. I think it is worth noting that bubonic plague, again, believed to have caused the Black Death, was a major focal point of Third Reich biological warfare research. The Third Reich's biological warfare research program was disguised as a cancer research program. One suspects that perhaps the National Cancer Institute's viral cancer program was a knockoff or an imitation of the, or an extension of the Third Reich's, quote, cancer research, unquote, program, which was a biological warfare research program. We're going to review some information that we looked at in For the Record, in AFA 39. This is from Operation Paperclip by Annie Jacobson, hardcover with Brown and Company. Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-E-N. Now, this involves Dr. Kurt Blome, B-L-O-M-E. He was the Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich and in charge of the Third Reich's basically their biological warfare program. It was disguised as a cancer research program. One of the things that Blome was doing was researching bubonic plague, basically the, quote, Black Death, unquote. He was doing this, again, under the auspices of a cancer research facility established by the Third Reich. He was doing this at the behest of Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler. And Blome became one of the world's experts on bubonic plague / the Black Death. After the war, he went to work for the U.S. under the auspices of Project Paperclip. And one of the questions I am obviously asking here is, did the research that was conducted by Kurt Blome, whether it involved bubonic plague, certainly, whether the discovery was made by the Third Reich, which in many important respects was ahead of much of the rest of the world in scientific knowledge, did they discover, as the Japanese apparently did, the viral hemorrhagic fever that actually was the cause, appears now to have been the cause of the Black Death? I think that that is a question that, it needs to be answered, but the fact that the Third Reich was researching plague, that they were doing so at the behest of Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler, that Kurt Blome became one of the world's experts on bubonic plague and the Black Death, and that he did so while using a front which was a cancer research facility, and that after the war, Kurt Blome went to work for the U.S. I think that is something that needs to be very carefully considered in the context of AIDS and the fact that purebred Northern Europeans, or, quote, Aryans, unquote, contain a gene which also conferred immunity to the Black Death that gives them immunity to HIV infection. Reviewing some quotes from or excerpts from Operation Paperclip by Annie Jacobson. We also had this in AFA 39. The War Crimes Office had considerable information about Dr. Kurt Blome. He was Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich and vice president of the Reich's Physicians League, the Reichsarztkammer. He was believed to have reported directly to Hermann Goering and maybe even to Himmler or to both. Blohm had been named head of Reich Cancer Research in 1942. Alsace, that was an allied intelligence operation to secure top Nazi scientists, and the OSS presumed that this was a cover name for biological weapons work. Blohm was a dedicated and proud Nazi. And another excerpt. Major E.W.B. Gill, G.I.L.L., asked how Blohm, a, quote, cancer expert, unquote, had been put in charge of the Reich's bioweapons program, a subject he claimed to know very little about. Blohm said he had no answer for that. And still later. Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler had a layman's fascination with biological warfare. A former chicken farmer, the Reichsführer SS had studied agriculture in school. According to Blohm, it was Himmler who was the primary motivator behind the Reich's bioweapons program. Hitler, Blohm said, did not approve of biological warfare and was kept in the dark as to specific plans. Himmler's area of greatest fascination, said Blohm, was bubonic plague. And still later. Blohm then told Himmler that if he were to experiment with plague bacterium, he would name his own institute, an isolated facility far removed from population centers. Himmler and Blohm agreed that Poland would be a good place, and they settled on Neselstedt, M-E-S-S-E-L-S-T-E-D-T, a small town outside the former Poznan University, by then operated by the Third Reich. Blohm's research was to be called the Bacteriological Institute at Neselstedt. And still later. Dr. Kurt Blohm's expertise was in great demand, but his future was as yet undecided. In his Posen laboratory, Blohm had made considerable progress with live plague pathogens, including bubonic and pneumonic plague. How far that research progressed remained vague, likely because it would put an unwanted spotlight on human experiments many believed had taken place there. And still later. As for Dr. Blohm, he was seen as a highly desirable recruit for Operation Paperclip. Blohm allegedly knew more about bubonic plague research than anyone else in the world. But given his foreign position in Hitler's inner circle, coupled with the fact that Blohm had worn the gold party badge bringing him to America as part of Operation Paperclip, remained too difficult for the U.S. Army to justify. But as the Cold War gained momentum and intense suspicion of the Soviets increased, even someone like Kurt Blohm would eventually be deemed eligible for Operation Paperclip. I also noted in a number of shows, 606 and 682, that Franz Lizau Zacharias, who secured the monkeys that were used initially for Third Reich biological and chemical warfare research, was in high demand by the Allies at the end of World War II. Many of the apes that he got for the Third Reich died. I have speculated that what was going on was that the simian immunodeficiency virus, or SIV, a virus that is native to the African green monkey, but to which the African green monkey has ultimately developed a symbiotic relationship. It does not die from infection by SIV, but other primate species, particularly macaques, have in fact been very susceptible to SIV. Certainly, the Allies knew how to get monkeys out of Africa. They didn't need somebody to teach them how to do that. So it was something else about Zacharias that made him a much-wanted individual. I suspect that he had come across some sort of infectious, immune-destroying agent that would devastate the immune systems of primates, and that this was deemed to have application for post-war biological warfare research. I suspect that he had come across the SIV. Again, that is speculation. What we're going to do is to firm up the fact that Bayer's acquisition of Monsanto, has in fact been finalized. Sullivan and Cromwell was the counsel for Bayer on this, the old Dulles law firm. And the BASF, the world's largest chemical company, and like Bayer, a member of the old IG Farben firm, is going to purchase billions of dollars of Monsanto properties to enable the deal to go through antitrust regulators. From CNBC, from May 29th of 2018, U.S. forces Germany's Bayer to shed $9 billion in agricultural business in biggest ever antitrust sell-off. This by Dan Mangan, M-A-N-G-A-N. Drug maker Bayer agreeing to the largest divestiture in American antitrust enforcement history will sell agricultural businesses and assets worth $9 billion to chemical giant BASF, clearing the way for approval of its $66 billion acquisition of Monsanto, the Justice Department announced Tuesday. The assets include Bayer's canola, soybean, and vegetable seed businesses, as well as its Liberty herbicide business, all of which currently compete with Monsanto products. What we're going to do next is to listen to an excerpt from For the Record 576, which we also used in For the Record 912. This is from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, and it indicates how the companies that came out of IG Farben, Bayer, BASF, and Hoechst, now merged with another company, remained under the control of the Bormann Group.
At this meeting, described on page 25 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Dr. Scheid, again, SS general and the personal representative of Martin Bormann, at this meeting, discusses how the Third Reich is going to survive military defeat, and that is basically to rejoin the international corporate community and to utilize the connections between powerful German corporations and not only their subsidiaries abroad, but their cartel partners, including powerful American corporations, to survive. Dr. Scheid said, "The Battle of France is lost to Germany," he admitted, quoting Reichsleiter Bormann as his authority, "and now the defense of the Siegfried Line and Germany itself is the main problem. From now on, German industry must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign, with each industrial firm making new contacts and alliances with foreign firms. This must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion. However, the Nazi Party and the Third Reich will stand behind every firm with permissive and financial support." Skipping down. Dr. Scheid also affirmed the ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war, unquote. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that, quote, "patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated of New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern." He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line, parenthetically linked to the Bush family, as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Well, last time I checked, New York was in the United States. And later the afternoon of August 10th, a smaller conference in the afternoon was presided over by Dr. Busse of the German Armaments Ministry. It was attended only by representatives of Hecko, Krupp, and Röckling. Dr. Busse restated Bormann's belief that the war was all but lost, but that it would be continued by Germany until certain goals to ensure the economic resurgence of Germany after the war had been achieved. He added that German industrialists must be prepared to finance the continuation of the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground just as had the Maquis in France, and the IG Farben firm was to be a key for the post-war capital resurgence of Germany. Skipping down yet again, I.G. Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Bormann in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with I.G.'s Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general and to I.G. in particular. Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on I.G. Farben would be so great that despite German defeat, I.G. in one way or another could regain its position of control of the European chemical business. They will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories, as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves. And it was, again, IG Farben's worldwide industrial infrastructure and espionage capabilities and the Nazi Party organization within German corporations abroad that were essential for the post-war capital flight, which became the Bormann Capital Network, and which led to ultimately the economic resurgence not only of Germany, but the post-war underground perpetuation of the Third Reich's power, albeit in an economic, not military, form. Still later, Paul Manning, in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, discusses the worldwide espionage and corporate infrastructure of IG Farben, how it was inextricably linked with the Nazi Party, and how in turn this was utilized for the post-war capital flight. IG Farben's NW7 office in Berlin compiled military and economic data on all countries for the Wehrmacht. This department was staffed with men of recognized ability in all branches of business and science. It was under the direction of Dr. Max Ilgner, nephew of Hermann Schmitz, IG's president, who was known throughout the industrial world as the master of financial camouflage, unquote. Farben had offices and representatives in 93 countries, and no social gathering of businessmen was too small to be covered by an NW7 representative whose reports on market conditions, factory installations, raw material supplies, and research were transmitted immediately to Berlin and Dr. Ilgner. In the United States, NW7 operated through the firm of Chemnico Incorporated, an American foreign subsidiary. Chemnico sent tremendous amounts of information ranging from photographs and blueprints to detailed descriptions of entire industrial complexes and secret processes. From the United States, the new method for production of isooctane used for motor fuels was obtained. A leading IG scientist has stated that this important process originated entirely with the Americans and had become known to us in detail in its separate stages, unquote. The process for producing tetraethyl lead, essential for the manufacture of aviation gasoline, was obtained by Farben in the same way. An IG official commenting on the importance of this acquisition stated, "Without lead tetraethyl, the present method of warfare would be unthinkable. The fact that since the beginning of the war we could produce lead tetraethyl is entirely due to the circumstances that shortly before the Americans had presented us with the production plans complete with experimental knowledge. Thus, the difficult work of development, we need only recall the poisonous property of lead tetraethyl, which caused many deaths in the United States, was spared us since we could take up the manufacture of this product together with all the experience that the Americans had gathered over long years," unquote. By the way, the story of that and how IG Farben helped Germany get tetraethyl lead and other technologies is discussed at length in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 and For the Record, program number 511.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Continuing more about IG Farben's infrastructure. To be sure, IG's own research facilities produced many a scientific breakthrough for the Third Reich. Its experts developed the noted Buna process for the manufacture of synthetic rubber, freeing Germany from dependence on natural rubber. It developed the hydrogenation process for making motor fuels and lubricating oils from coal. Germany's shortage of bauxite, the raw material essential to manufacture aluminum, was surmounted by its developments in utilizing the element magnesium. This was a time of stockpiling. What NW7 could not purloin, IG's board of directors asked for under cartel agreements with other international firms. In one instance, it purchased 500 tons of lead for production of high-grade aviation gasoline obtained by a Farben Swiss subsidiary from the Ethyl Export Corporation of America. As it made such purchases on the world market in the late 30s, Farben continued to produce and stockpile everything useful to the German armed forces. Of 43 major products by Farben, 28 were primary needs of war makers. IG made all the synthetic rubber in Germany, all the methanol, the serums, and the lubricating oils. IG provided 95% of the poisonous gases, as well as over 90% of the nickel and plastics. 88% of the magnesium derivatives used by the Luftwaffe in its aircraft and incendiary bombs came from Farben, as did most of the nitrogen and explosives for the flying bombs in the V-2s. No other German war industry could have functioned without Farben's raw materials and technical assistance. This huge organization functioned as a manufacturing and research arm of the German government, with the responsibility of discovering all possible means of increasing the military power of Germany. More than 4.25 billion Reichsmarks was invested in new plants, mines, and power installations, with other millions going into new research facilities. Skipping down, so close had Farben become to the government that IG always knew in advance all invasions planned by Hitler. It was to supply the materials necessary to each conquest, and when a land had been overrun and subjugated, the Farben experts would handle the consolidation and organization of the industrial facilities as additional supply sources for the German armed forces. As German troops swept across Europe and Hitler proclaimed his vision of a thousand-year Reich, IG Farben also dreamed of world empire. This was outlined with clarity in a document called New Ordnung, or New Order, that was accompanied by a letter of transmittal to the Ministry of Economics. It declared that a new order for the chemical industry of the world should supplement Hitler's new order. Therefore, the document stated, Farben was fitting future industrial plans into such a framework, i.e. a new world order for the chemical industry, paralleling and directly growing out of Hitler's new world order. Skipping down. The close relationship of Farben to the Third Reich leadership was underscored in other ways. IG's leading officials assisted in the formulation and execution of economic policies of government. Its president was a member of the Reichstag, its leading scientist was a chief assistant to Hermann Göring under the four-year plan, its statisticians and economists prepared intelligence for the Nazi high command. Scores of its technicians were at any given time on loan to the air and war ministries. Skipping down, the contact men of NW7 throughout the world were called the IG Verbundungsmänner, the liaison officers between IG Farben back in Germany and the branches elsewhere. These IG Verbindungsmänner, as well as the other key Farben representatives working beyond the borders of the Third Reich, were members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Their loyalty to Hitler and to the new order was uncompromising. Skipping down again. So now, Martin Bormann had at his command not only the Auslandsorganisation, but also the IG Verbundungsmänner of Farben, which could be counted on to heed his orders when it was time to disperse the commercial assets of the Third Reich. And chief among those were the assets of IG Farben. And as you can see in the description for the Record 305 and in reading the book itself, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Hermann Schmitz and the other elements of the IG were of great use to Martin Bormann in the Flight Capital Program. Talking about what took place after World War II, by the way, Manning's book was published in 81, the economic unification of West Germany is complete, and if there is any doubt in Europe who in the long run won the peace, there is none whatsoever among the former German leaders dwelling in South America. It is a good bet that if IG Farben's Hermann Schmitz were alive today, he would bear witness as to who really won the war. Schmitz died contented, having witnessed the resurgence of IG Farben, albeit in altered corporate forms, a money machine that continues to generate profits for all the old IG shareholders, an enormous international power for the German cadre directing the workings of the successor firms. To all appearances, Schmitz died in relatively reduced circumstances in 1960 at the age of 79, though immensely wealthy during his lifetime. Any information about his fortune seemingly vanished with his death, but those who know him believe it still exists. He was the master manipulator, the corporate and financial wizard, the magician who could make money appear and disappear and reappear again. His whole existence was leisure domain played out on the game board of IG Farben in his beloved Germany. The son of poor parents, born in Essen in 1981, a loner who made it to the top through ability, diligence, hard work, and singleness of purpose, he resembled Martin Bormann, who likewise had more than just a feel for mathematics but never went beyond high school and had to make it on his own. Their association was close and trusting over the years, and it is the considered opinion of those in their circle that the wealth possessed by Hermann Schmitz was shifted to Switzerland and to South America and placed in trust with Bormann, the legal heir to Hitler. Schmitz's wealth, largely IG Farben bearer bonds, converted to the big three successor firms, shares in Standard Oil of New Jersey equal to those held by the Rockefellers, General Motors, and other U.S. blue-chip industrial stocks, and the 700 secret companies controlled in his time by IG, as well as shares in the 750 corporations he helped Martin Bormann establish during the last year of World War II, has increased in all segments of the modern industrial world. The Bormann organization in South America utilizes the voting power of the Schmitz Trust, along with their own assets, to guide the multinationals they control as they keep steady the economic course of the fatherland. And still more about IG Farben and its post-war resurgence, skipping down once again. By 1956, the three major multinationals, Hoechst, BASF, and Bayer, reshaped from the 159 companies within Germany that had comprised IG Farben, were generating record profits for the original 450 major Farben stockholders, who had organized themselves into the IG Farben Stockholders Protective Committee in Bonn. The big three went on expanding, tripling capitalization in 1956 from investment funds that poured in from the interlocking companies established in safe haven companies by Martin Bormann and Hermann Schmitz. There was a return more vigorous than ever of the huge, monolithic industrial multinationals that dominated the German economy before and during World War II. Each of these three spin-offs from IG Farben today does more business individually than did Farben at its zenith when its corporate structure covered 93 countries. BASF and Bayer individually boast worldwide sales of nearly $10 billion annually, while Hoechst, now the world's largest chemical company, generated $16.01 billion in worldwide sales in 1980. Each does more business than E.I. DuPont de Nemours with sales of $9.4 billion. Skipping down. Together, these three multinationals assure permanent prosperity for the original 450 Farben stockholders, their banks, and the shadowy shareholders of the Bormann Organization in South America who guard and vote the Hermann Schmitz Trust Fund through intermediaries at the annual meetings of BASF, Bayer, and Hoechst. And, of course, the schemes of economic control that were so carefully crafted by people like Hermann Schmitz and Martin Bormann and others for the post-war revival of the German economy exist to this day, and the available evidence suggests very strongly that they control Citgo, consequently, also Smartmatic, and also Sequoia. And of the Bormann Capital Organization's position astride German industry and through the international cartel system, the rest of the world, atop an organizational, but this is from Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, Borman is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Borman, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, the chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Skipping down. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Borman organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. All orders come from the shareholders in South America, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Borman.
That again from For the Record 576 and For the Record 912 and Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile. We have spoken in the past about the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk. I believe that it is far more than the novel it purports to be. I believe that it is a blueprint for what is going on. And there is an excerpt that is in the written description for the Record 1012. I'm not going to take the time to read it, but it talks about how the post-war SS economic underground has operated. I will excerpt a short section of it. The SS realized that the world is heading towards a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5 we've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we are slowly gaming. And we are going to once again take a look at the company that I suspect may very well be a Borman company. It involves the fabulously wealthy Reimann family, R-E-I-M-A-N-N. Their firm is J.A.B. Holdings. They also invest with, they cross-invest and have an interlocking executive management structure with 3G Capital. That's Jorge Paulo Lehmann company that we looked at in For the Record 912 and in AFA number 39. JAB Holdings has a number of very well-known brands under their control. They are moving, like the 3G Capital, into the food business, and in particular appear to be going for dominance in the global coffee market, U.S. in particular. They also are picking up things that are associated with the coffee industry. There are a number of articles about the Reimann family that will be in the written description for the Record 1012. I'm going to excerpt some of them from the Financial Times of March 10th of 2016 by James Schotter, S-H-O-T-T-E-R. Germany's intensely private and immensely wealthy Reimann family. Last year, a group called JAB Holdings splashed out $13.9 billion to add Keurig Green Mountain, the biggest group in the U.S. single-serve coffee market, to its growing list of coffee investments. The deal capped a three-year, $30 billion acquisition spree, during which JAB bought up groups ranging from instant coffee specialists in Europe to hipster coffee chains in the U.S., and prompted suggestions that a challenger to Nestle's dominant Nespresso brand could be emerging. At the same time, the deal sparked another round of interest in the principal owners of JAB Holding, four members of Germany's intensely private and immensely wealthy Reimann family, Wolfgang, Stefan, Renata, and Matthias. Through JAB, the family owns stakes in some of the world's best-known brands. as well as its investments in the coffee sector. JAB's burgeoning portfolio encompasses an 8% stake in Reckitt Benckiser, the consumer goods conglomerate, and a 77.4% stake in the U.S. fragrance group Coty, which owns the Calvin Klein and David Beckham perfume brands. On top of this, the holding company also controls luxury marquees Jimmy Choo, Bali, and Ballstaff. It talks about the history of the company, skipping down. The last of the Ludwig Reimann descendants, that's the founder of the company, Ludwig Reimann, the last of the Reimanns to be actively involved in the day-to-day running of Benckiser was Albert Jr., Ludwig's great-grandson, who inherited the company in 1952 and pushed it in the direction of consumer goods. He died in 1984, leaving equal stakes to his 9 adopted children. Although all 9 of Albert's adopted children initially kept the 11.1% stakes they inherited, by 2003, Wolfgang and Renata, again, they're all adopted, who are siblings, and Matthias and Stefan, who are brothers, had bought out the other 5. And, this company invests with 3G Capital. There are articles talking about some of the other coffee properties that they have. Jacob Duve Egberts, they have controlling interest in Pete's Coffee. When you go to Pete's Coffee, they're going to a JAB company. Caribou Coffee, Einstein Noah Restaurant Group, Espresso House, and Barrasso Coffee. This could come from Serpent's Walk, this next quote. This, however, is from the St. Louis Post Dispatch of May 9th of 2016, a Bloomberg story by Kevin Orland, billionaire Reimann adding Krispy Kreme donuts to its empire in $1.35 billion deal. They've been slowly amassing a pretty big umbrella of breakfast and coffee-oriented brands, and so Krispy Kreme slides underneath that umbrella pretty easily, said Will Slabaugh, an analyst at Stevens Incorporated. They're headquartered in Luxembourg. The family now lives in Vienna. Talking about how secretive they are. This from Forbes magazine of December 7th of 2015, article by Max Jaedur Palmgren, Jaedur-Palmgren. The secretive billionaire family behind the $13.9 billion Keurig Green Mountain deal. Just as they wish it to be, you have probably never heard of the Reimann family. Chances are, however, that you have come across the products of their empire multiple times a day. Maybe it's a pair of Jimmy Choo shoes, Durex condoms, Pete's Coffee, a Mondelez snack, or Calvin Klein fragrances. Skipping down. The siblings are descendants of German chemist Ludwig Reimann, who in 1828 joined Johann Adam Benckiser and his namesake company in Ludwigshafen, Germany. By marrying one of Benckiser's daughters, Reimann ended up inheriting the entire company. His grandson Albert Reimann took the reins in 1952 and decided to steer the company in a new direction, adding consumer goods to its business. When he had died in 1984, his 9 adopted children, none of whom had ever worked for the business or had any role in its operations, each inherited 11.1% of the company. The lack of involvement is allegedly part of the family policy, which includes signing a codex on one's 18th birthday, pledging to stay out of the public eye as much as possible, thus making them one of the most private billionaire families. And there's a group of 3 managers who basically make the decisions for the Reimann family. But again, at the age of 18, they sign a codex pledging to stay out of the public eye. I strongly suspect that, like 3G Capital, this is a Bormann company. A New York Post story from April 10th of 2017 by Josh Kosman, K-O-S-M-A-N. Buffett-backed firm interested in bid for Panera Bread talks about a rivalry between JAB and Jorge Paulo Lemann's 3G Capital that we spoke about in For the Record 912 and AFA 39. I would note that Olivier Goudet, as written here, JAB's chief executive, is chair of 3G's Anheuser-Busch InBev. And then concluding with an article from the Venture Capital Post of September 17th of 2015, Brazilian PE firm 3G Capital eyes SAB Miller. And it talks about the holders in 3G Capital. The world's well-known fund manager William Ackman also recently invested in 3G Capital. Other major investors include Colombia's Santo Domingo family, tennis player Roger Federer, and JAB Holdings, which handles Germany's Reimann family assets. I strongly suspect that what we are looking here is like the great amoeba discussed in the Serpent's Walk excerpt. We are looking at that corporate amoeba from the Borman Group slowly gobbling up the food business. And when one considers what controlling the world's food supply and the pharmaceutical business would enable a company that would have access to a genetically engineered binary pathogen to which only purebred Northern Europeans had a hereditary immunity, well, again, that is something to be called food for thought and grounds for further research. This concludes For the Record Program 1012, Food for Thought Part 2, being recorded on June 26th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.